It is the so-called post-truth era. It's an age of alternate facts where scientists are left scratching their heads at how to talk about many really important issues that we're currently facing. For example, it was just 4 years ago that a member of Congress brought a snowball to the Senate floor as proof that climate change doesn't exist. And just listen to how President Trump talked about climate change while speaking with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes last fall.
I'm not denying climate change, but it could very well go back. You know, we're talking about over millions of years. They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say.
You mean well, people say, on the people phone? Say that in the...
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
You'd have to show me the scientists because they have a very big political agenda, Leslie.
I can't bring them
scientists
in.
Scientists also have a political agenda.
Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He has a new book called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. And he joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston, Lee.
Thank you so much.
So why'd you write the book?
Well, I'm a philosopher of science, so I've always been interested in the question of what's distinctive about science. But one thing that occurred to me now in particular is that science is under attack. Science really needs to be defended. So it's no longer just of academic interest what's the difference between science and non-science. I thought that philosophers really needed to make a contribution to say what's different about science and how can we use that to fight back against science denial, fraud, and pseudoscience.
One of the things that was really interesting was this concept of the scientific attitude, which is in the title of the book. I know you wanted to focus on attitude and values in science as opposed to something like the scientific method. Why was that the important thing to emphasize?
Well, about 100 years ago, philosophers started to try to solve something called the problem of demarcation, which is this formal logical method for figuring out the difference between science and non-science. And it hasn't worked. It's been 100 years, and which means that we've had 100 years of not really being able to defend science. And I got to thinking about it, and what it seemed to me was really distinctive about science was the set of values that scientists have. I think of the scientific attitude as being, first, that scientists care about evidence, but second, that they're willing to be open to new evidence changing their mind. It's the second part that's really crucial. That's the distinction.
Why is it so important to be open to changing your mind?
Well, if you think about how an ideologue approaches an empirical question, they're not open to changing their mind. If you show them evidence, they'll discount the evidence or they'll say, we'll wait till more evidence comes in. They'll find any excuse not to change their mind. But in science, because the value is you have to get it right. And if you don't get it right, your colleagues are going to get it right for you. They're going to test it and maybe humiliate you if you're not following the rules. That's something that scientists live by. It's really the creed of science that you need to live and die by the evidence. And when the evidence says, you know, maybe you want to believe that your theory is true, but the evidence says that it's not true, you have to modify or eventually give up the theory.
So we've been kind of talking about this moment that we're in and why it's important to write this book now. But, I mean, you can go all the way back to Galileo and further. We've always had people who are either denying of a new scientific discovery or they're anti-science or they're skeptics of science. Is there something different going on now or is this just a repeat of previous history?
Well, you're absolutely right. Science denial has been around as long as science has been around. Look back to Galileo, Giordano Bruno, Semmelweis. These are all famous cases. Cases of resistance to science. Modern science denial really started in the 1950s when the big tobacco companies were faced with this new study that was going to show a fairly definitive link between smoking and lung cancer.
Interesting.
And they fought it by bringing in a public relations expert who said, you've got to start your own research institute. You've got to mount a public relations campaign. And that became the model for modern science denial. That story is very well told in Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway's book, Merchants of Doubt. And what happened is that became the blueprint or the model for climate change denial, evolution denial, anti-vax. It all started in the 50s. Fast forward to the last two decades, the internet has been terrible for science denial.
Why has the internet been such a problem?
Well, I remember in the late 1960s, I heard from my mom, I think, that there were some people who thought that we hadn't gone to the moon. And I thought, how could this be? This seemed very strange. And I mean, so there, you know, back then there were people who thought we hadn't gone to the moon, but you'd never met one. They didn't have any way to get their word out. Now they do. Now, just about any idea that you have, you can find confirmation for it on the internet. And I think that this has led to a distrust of scientists. It's led people to think that they're their own experts and they can just go down this rabbit hole or silo or whatever metaphor you want to use to feed that confirmation bias to think that they're right and the scientists are wrong. And that's been disastrous for science.
Now, Lee, you know, one of the promises of the internet was to connect people. And one of the things that's come up, I think, both in your book and other places, is that scientists often disengage and don't engage with someone who says, I don't believe in climate change, or I don't think the science is settled, or evolution is just a theory. You know, what's the dialogue that's important to happen? And is it a mistake for scientists to not engage with people who are skeptical or not buying into scientific discovery?
I think it is a mistake for them not to engage, but I mean, really, can you blame them? You heard the clip from Trump. I mean, those sorts of claims that scientists are in it only for the money or that they've got a political agenda. I mean, that's just not how science actually works. And so I think when scientists confront science deniers, their reflex is to present their evidence. And then when their evidence isn't accepted or their integrity is questioned, they walk away.
Is it necessarily a problem, though, to be skeptical of scientific fact? I mean, one of the things that your book talks about is you've always got to be open to the possibility that you're
That's
wrong,
right.
That new data could come along and refute what you've been arguing.
No, it's a great point, but that has to be done in good faith, right? That has to be done in such a way that the person is actually open to having their mind changed by the new evidence. And for science deniers, that's really not what they do. So what I'm recommending is that what scientists do more of is talk about how rigorous science is, talk about data sharing, talk about peer review, talk about replication and probability. It's a nerdy thing to talk about, but science cannot ever prove something 100%. It's not the same as deductive logic. That just doesn't work in the sciences. But I think that doesn't mean that scientific hypotheses or theories are not well warranted. And scientists need to say more about that. They need to own the fact that uncertainty is a strength rather than a weakness of science.
Now, to do that, you have to engage.
Yes.
And one of the things that I understand is that you do go out and engage.
I do.
I heard about a really fascinating experience that you had at a conference for flat earthers a few years ago. Is that true?
Yeah, it wasn't even that long ago. It was November 2018 in Denver, the Flat Earth International Conference. And I had my book, Scientific Attitude, was already in page proof, so it was already done. And I thought, you know, I'm recommending that scientists follow this advice to get out there and engage with science deniers and talk about their values. So I'm going to do it. And so I bought the badge and I went. And the first day, I didn't say anything. I just listened. But the second day, I engaged. I mean, there were 600 absolutely true believers there. Some of my friends in advance said, well, they're just goofing. They're just trolling. They don't really believe it. They absolutely believed it and made the claim that they had evidence for flat Earth, which was what the seminars were about. So I took notes. I mean, I knew all of their arguments. So the second day, my claim against them was I wasn't going to present them with evidence because it had been around for 2,300 years and they didn't believe it. So what I did was I said the question we talked about earlier, what would it take to prove you wrong? And they couldn't answer it. And if you can't answer that question, you're not a scientist. You're not following the scientific attitude. You're not actually caring about evidence.
So here's part of what I'm struggling with in that. One of the things that your book talks about is the importance. Okay, so you can't prove something for forever and a day because there could be new evidence. You have
That's
to be
right.
open to the possibility that you're wrong. But you also talk in your book about the fact that repeated experimentation and trial and data can create believability.
That's right.
Okay. So then I think what's on my mind is, but if the threshold is believability, one can make many things believable. So how do we find that intersection of increased data is important for believability, but there are many ways to create. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think that the important point is that even though scientists can't reach certainty, they aim to get as close as they can. So there are degrees of believability. Okay, I'll give you an example. I just read in Reuters the other day that the evidence for climate change, anthropogenic climate change, is now at the five sigma level, which means it's a one out of a million chance that the science deniers, that the climate change deniers are right. I mean, one out of a million. So, you know, you never go to a doctor who said he had a one out of a million chance of curing you. You know, mm-hmm. you wouldn't stake your life on that. So I don't understand why climate change deniers are willing to say, oh, well, until it's settled science, until all the data come in, which it'll never be, you know, we can't do anything about climate change.
Is the science on what to do about it settled?
Well, there are many different things that we might do. Those are in some ways policy debates or values debates. What I'm interested in is, in my book, what I'm interested in professionally is these sorts of political disputes over factual debates, which really shouldn't be happening. I mean, if somebody is willing to say, you know what, climate change is real, but it's not worth spending the money to do something about it, then we're having a values debate. We're not having a factual debate. Mm-hmm. The trouble that I have is that so many people don't understand that distinction, and they want to be able to say, well, I don't want to believe it's true, therefore it's not true.
So one of the things that you said, you've talked about it, values, and you've talked about it being politicized, policy.
Yes.
But this one does play out on both sides of the political aisle, and I want to make sure to mention that. Let's take GMOs, for example. Here's Dr. Peter Goldsborough. He's a professor of botany and plant pathology at Purdue. I want to hear from him for a sec.
The broadly held consensus by the vast, vast majority of scientists and medical professionals is that the GMOs that are currently available on the market have no health problems that are any different than conventional foods.
And yet environmentalists and others on the left, like Senator Bernie Sanders, have strongly campaigned. You got a label. You have to have labeling requirements for food products that include GMOs. So this is an issue from both sides of the political aisle. And sooner or later, scientific fact does affect policy. We can't just separate those two conversations. So our listeners, there's a listener somewhere out there who's thinking about where policy meets science. And pretty soon they're going to be at a family event where they're going to talk to some family member who sees a scientific fact differently or doesn't agree with it or is denying it. What's the roadmap for that conversation? How do we help people have that in their own lives?
I think the thing that you've got to do is recognize that for some people, belief about empirical subjects can be emotional. The one that comes up the most these days that you read about in the news is anti-vax. Anti-vaxxers love their children just as much as anybody else does, and they're afraid, and they don't know what to believe. They're confused. This is a good example where the science is absolutely clear. The study that Andrew Wakefield did has been debunked, shown to be a fraud.
But this was a published document, a scholarly journal article,
yes,
that has been the basis for most of the anti-vax argument. Is that correct?
Yes, it was his spurious claim that there was a link between vaccines and the MMR vaccine and autism. So I think the way to talk to people about this is, number one, to talk. People change their... So I'm a connoisseur of the literature about how people change their minds on this, on climate change, on vaccines, on GMOs.
How do they?
Well, it's based on trust. It's based on one-on-one individual conversations. So, for instance, I went to the Flat Earth Convention, which, I mean, I didn't maybe build a lot of trust, you know, 600 to 1, because I was definitely the outlier. But I took people to dinner. I talked to them. I spent the time. I was there for the full 48 hours. I really tried to build trust just by showing up, by taking the argument seriously, as seriously as you can. I mean, taking the person seriously, not the argument. The showing respect, not insulting somebody. These all help. If you look at the literature about how people change their mind about empirical topics, they almost always do so from a one-on-one engagement with somebody who they trust, who helped them to change their mind.
And were you able to better understand the perspective of the people at the Flat Earth Conference having built that trust? Were they more open, and were you able to have a higher quality discussion?
In some cases, yes. But I have to say, what I came away with was the understanding that quite a number of them were conspiracy theorists. So while I can't say that I understand that because I don't believe in the conspiracy theories that they do, I did come to understand that from their point of view, quite a number of them were truther conspiracists about 9/11. And some of them said that they became radicalized by that because a government that could lie to us about 9/11 could lie to us about flat Earth.
All right. So before we end, I just need one hopeful sentence. One hopeful sentence.
Engagement.
All right. Great. All the way down to a word. Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and author of The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Lee, thanks for coming with.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.